With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to Forma, a podcast contemplating the intersection between classical thought and contemporary culture. I'm David Kern. Today's episode is brought to you by the Honors College at Azusa Pacific University, which prepares the next generation of Christian leaders through a Great Books course of study emphasizing faith, wisdom, and virtue. Honor students at Azusa Pacific enjoy several benefits, including an honor scholarship, small Socratic-style classes, a curriculum with no secondary textbooks, exams, or busy work, exemption from general education courses, access to honors housing, and free trips to world-class arts experiences across Southern California. If you'd like to learn more about the Honors College at Azusa Pacific University, head over to apu.edu/honors. That's apu.edu/honors. My guest today on Forma is Dr. Andrew Roberts, author of a new biography of Winston Churchill. It's called Churchill, Walking with Destiny. The Sunday Times in the UK calls this a terrific book with bursts with character, humor, and incident on almost every page. Roberts tells this story with enormous confidence, drawing on a vast range of sources to present what is undoubtedly the best single-volume life of Churchill ever written. End quote. Dr. Roberts, who is the best-selling author of The Storm of War, A New History of the Second World War, and Master and Commanders, How Four Titans Won the War in the West, as well as Napoleon, A Life, is the winner of the LA Times Book Prize for Biography. He's won many prizes, including the Wolfson History Prize and the British Army Military Book Award. He frequently writes for the Wall Street Journal and is the Roger and Martha Mertz Visiting Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He lives in London and often lectures in New York, which is where he's going to be actually early in November. If you are interested and you're in the New York area, you can hear Dr. Roberts lecture about this Churchill book November 5th and 6th in New York. But he's also going to be touring throughout the U.S. and Canada throughout this fall and into the spring. If you would like to learn more about how you might be able to hear him speak, you can head over to andrew-roberts.net. When writing this book, Dr. Roberts was granted access to exclusive new material. Queen Elizabeth allowed him to study her father, King George VI's wartime diaries, which were filled with Churchill's jokes, critiques, and reflections on how the war was going. Plus, he studied the transcripts of war cabinet meetings, the equivalent of the Nixon and JFK tapes, diaries, letters, unpublished memoirs, and detailed notes taken by the king after their biweekly meetings, all of which provide a wonderful new historical source. All of this, as Dr. Roberts indicates in the interview, was not available even as recently as 10 years ago. So this is the first biography of Churchill to include a great deal of these resources. As the book says, we think of Churchill as a hero of the age of mechanized warfare. But Roberts' masterwork reveals that he has as much to teach us about the challenges we face today and the fundamental values of courage, tenacity, leadership, and moral conviction. And with that, I'm going to send you over to my interview with Dr. Andrew Roberts, author of Churchill, Walking with Destiny. Enjoy. Whenever I talk to someone who is British, I always feel so uncivilized. I feel like we Americans have we still have an inferiority complex when it comes to culture.
So of course, you won the War of Independence, so I don't see why you should.
Well, we may be independent, but I don't know that we've sustained culture the way.
I assure you, we take every advantage as much as we possibly can from that.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that as I was reading through some of your book and thinking about how we're going to be talking about a member of the British aristocracy. And you mentioned in the book that he was very aware, keenly aware of his advantages. Is that something that he carried with him throughout his whole life, that he took into his positions of power and that influenced the way he sort of wielded that power?
I think it gave him enormous self-confidence, certainly. But I don't think he was a snob. He wasn't somebody who thought that because he was a member of the aristocracy that therefore he was better than anybody else. but it did leave him tremendously rooted in his own sense of where he was in the world. And so he didn't doubt himself at all. And you get that a lot from the British aristocracy historically, and also and definitely him throughout his life, yes.
Did you think that that was one of those characteristics that was both good and bad, that it influenced him in positive ways, but also led him...
Positive ways, yes, absolutely. I mean, today, of course, to feel entitled, especially socially entitled, is considered to be one of the sort of worst flaws in a human being. But that wasn't the case in his time. And also, I think that he his self-confidence was absolutely natural to him. And of course, was so important because he was being vilified and criticized and subjected to appalling obloquy for so much of his life when he was saying the opposite of what most other people were saying, especially over the Nazis and the rise of Hitler. But he needed every ounce of self-confidence that he could get. And he got an awful lot of it from the fact that he'd been born in a palace and was the grandson of a duke.
Mm. You know, you mentioned in an interview that it's only now that we can really assess Churchill, you know, due to the passage of time, but also because there's newly available archival material. Given what we know now, do you think that he was justly assessed while he was in his positions of office? Or do you think that he was improperly negatively looked at by the English people, such that, you know, particularly in the 30s and the 50s?
Yes. I think he was wildly under assessed in the 1930s when people thought that he was a warmonger and a sort of danger to peace and so on. And then he was probably over assessed quite a lot in the 1950s when, especially after he left the premiership in April 1955, he was treated as though he could do no wrong. And neither of those are true, really. His is a much more interesting, much more nuanced story than that. I think that the reference to the new sources is interesting because there has been this great cornucopia of new information that has come out in the last decade, which I've been very fortunate to be able to use for this book. And that also has given us a much more nuanced view of the great man.
Hmm. It strikes me that some of that information has come available just as it seems like there's some of the criticism of Churchill seems to be being refreshed. And I don't know if that's as common in England as it is perhaps here.
Well, I mean, refreshed is a nice word for it, I think. You get, partly this is just due to the existence of the internet and where every absurd and ridiculous rumor or scandal mongering can suddenly be magnified and sent out to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people, where in the old days it would have just died in the sort of pub conversation, which is what it should have happened. But nonetheless, yes, he's got there's a new, very aggressive anti-Churchill sort of knocking revisionism that one sees in cyberspace. But all that one needs to do really is to stay calm and go back to the sources and look at the original documentation and the evidence and assess it. And under those circumstances, in 99 cases out of 100, it turns out that Churchill actually wasn't responsible for the things that he's being accused of.
Do you think that it's simply something that occurs with people who have been in positions of power and have a certain level of reputation that people begin to reconsider them and try to tear them apart?
No, well, of course that does happen to everybody, and it's not a bad thing. Of course, overall, I think history is a constant revision. We're always rewriting history, and so we should, and so we always will. The point is, though, that it's got to be done responsibly. And very often you get people who attack Churchill not because of any historically backed, evidentially backed reasons, but because of political assumptions, or because they are perverse in some way, or because they want to make a name for themselves, rather than really, because they've actually got anything useful or interesting historically to say.
Was there something about his personality that even during his life caused people to be inclined to criticize him? Or was it just simply the function of a man in power?
Oh, no. Churchill could put people's backs up immediately in a way that he recognized. He was very self-aware. He saw the way that he could irritate people at the drop of a hat. He was boisterous. He was bumptious. He was a show-off. And a lot of people hated that, especially, of course, people of his own class and background, for whom showing off was considered to be appalling socially. And so he was called a thruster and a pusher because he constantly was pushing himself forward. There are various reasons for that psychologically, which I go into in my book, not least because he didn't think he was going to live very long. Most of his family died early and young, and so he felt he had to push himself forward. But nonetheless, yes, he was criticized very heavily, pretty much from the moment he opened his mouth.
You've written pretty extensively about Churchill, but you've written pretty extensively about many historical figures, including Napoleon. But it seems like you continue to come back to Mr. Churchill, whether it's through articles or eventually now to a fairly substantial biography. What about his story and his work is so captivating to you? What does he mean to you personally?
I don't know that I'm going to come back to him anymore now. having written a very long biography of him, my publisher told me the other day that it was 540,266 words long. So wow. I'm not 100% certain that I'm going to need to return to Mr. Churchill for another decade at least. But nonetheless, it's a combination of things. Of course, it's the first part of his life is just one of the most extraordinary adventure stories. His many close brushes with death, his obsession with physical courage, his general, as we were mentioning earlier, his thrustingness and his pushiness, in direct contrast to what the rest of his class and background was expecting of him. And then after that, there's the combination of the physical courage and also the moral courage that we mentioned earlier, also about standing up to the conventions of the day, especially over the Nazis. And then later, of course, also over Stalinism and Soviet communism. And then you also have this sense of destiny. The reason I've called my book, subtitled my book, Walking with Destiny, is because he did have this extraordinary sense of personal destiny, which meant that his close brushes with death taught him that at least as he believed, that he was specially being looked after to ensure that there would be somebody who would save London and Britain and the Empire when the great day of struggle dawned. And in a lot of people, that would be considered a form of psychological disorder. But then obviously, when half a century later, that moment did come, he looked tremendously prescient.
As you were talking, I kept thinking how there was something like Theodore Roosevelt in him, to make an American comparison. Being maybe when he was younger, he didn't think he was going to live very long, and he became sort of obsessed with physical courage, and he had these great adventure stories before he ever took office. Did you find that Mr. Churchill, that he was very much like some of these other historical figures that you've studied, such as Napoleon? Or is one of the reasons that he appeals to you because he is sort of unique in certain ways?
Yes. Well, actually, that's very observant about Teddy Roosevelt, because he very much admired Teddy Roosevelt, but when they met, they didn't get on. And Teddy Roosevelt's niece said that's because they were too alike. that was the explanation for why they didn't click, which is a great shame, actually, because it would have been one of the great friendships in history. He worshipped Napoleon, which is always a dangerous thing to do. Nonetheless, he had a bust of Napoleon on his desk all the way through his life. He collected books on Napoleon. He quoted Napoleon constantly, and And actually, funny enough, in my book, Napoleon is mentioned pretty much more in the index than many of the living people who he did know. But he was like other people. I noticed some resemblances also with Admiral Nelson in that sense of mad personal bravery and certain total belief in his own sort of destiny and his own star. But overall, he is a sui generis figure. He's just, there's no one else like him. He might be like a few other people, but nobody else is really like Winston Churchill. Hmm.
You got access to all this archival information, including King George's wartime diaries. That must have been quite, I don't know what the word is, a journey just to access all of that. So how did that happen? How did you gain access to that? Did you have connections with the right people? I must have done,
but I didn't know it at the time. That's the way the Royal Archives work slightly, is that you keep asking and then you get no. And then suddenly on one glorious and wonderful moment when I was visiting Windsor Castle, they're all in the round tower there in the middle of the castle, right at the top of the tower. And the archivist there just told me that I was now going to be allowed to be the first Churchill biographer to use the King's diaries. And you can imagine how tremendously pleased with myself I was on that occasion. It was magnificent.
That must have been quite thrilling.
Yeah, of course. It was one of the great moments of my life, frankly, because I knew that the King and Churchill had lunch together every Tuesday of the war, and they served themselves from a side table, so it was to ensure that no servants needed to be present, because they were discussing secrets, the biggest secrets of the war, really, the ultra decrypt secret, the nuclear secret. He would tell the King if he was going to sack various people, and also which countries were going to be attacked when and under what circumstances. And so, you know, the great grand strategy of the war was being discussed very openly between Churchill and the King, because Churchill trusted the King implicitly. And so the great thing was that the King then went and wrote down everything Churchill said in his diary. So my book contains the hopes and fears and aperçus and gags of Winston Churchill every Tuesday of the Second World War. And it's a huge cornucopia of new information. But it's not by any means the only thing that we've got over the last 10 years. Since 2010, there have been 41 new sets of papers that have been deposited at Churchill College, Cambridge, the Churchill archives there, including Churchill's daughter's 1940 diary. And we've also had the diaries of Ivan Maisky, the Russian ambassador from 1932 to 43, and Pamela Harriman's love letters, which are great fun. And also, she had a very active love life during the Second World War, and the people who wrote to her also worked for and knew Churchill. And she, of course, was Churchill's daughter-in-law. So, you know, there's new information about Churchill there. And I also, in the last decade, discovered the verbatim account of the cabinet of the war cabinet minutes, which we hadn't got before. And so there's still plenty of stuff. There's virtually every page of this book has got quotations that have never appeared in the Churchill biography before.
What do those papers reveal about how the people who worked closest with him felt about him? It seems like, you know, the average person in the kingdom had a wide variety of responses, but those responses would have been informed by reputation or newspapers or, you know, whatever gets the rumors that get spread around. But what about the people who were closest to him, whether it was the King or people in his cabinet or his family members? Was there a sense of awe of him?
Not so much that. No, there was, in fact, right at the beginning, there was a great deal of distrust of him because he had got so many things wrong in his life. Mm. He had got women's suffrage wrong. He'd got the gold standard wrong. He'd got the Dardanelles catastrophe wildly wrong. He'd got the abdication crisis wrong, which was one of the reasons the King was rather nervous about him when he became prime minister. And so all in all, the people closest to him wanted to ensure that he wasn't going to get the Second World War wrong. But one thing that does come through very strongly from these new sources, and also from the old, of course, as well, of which there is a truly massive amount, there are 1,009 biographies of Winston Churchill, is the sheer emotionalism of the man. He was tremendously passionate, much more than most other politicians of the day, or indeed since. He burst into tears 50 times during the Second World War, for example. In public and private, but just as much in public as private, really. And which must have been deeply, you know, off-putting on occasion for people. Well, I imagine that were Theresa May, our Prime Minister, to burst into tears in the House of Commons, it would be a very sort of off-putting moment. You know, Sterling would crash.
Have quite the day.
Yeah, no, precisely. But Churchill was, the thing is that you see that he was not the stiff upper lipped, buttoned up Victorian aristocrat of his background and class and time, but in fact, a sort of throwback to the much more romantic Regency figure, those people who wore their hearts on their sleeves. Hmm.
Do you think that? Well, in what ways do you think that the leadership in the UK right now, in what ways do you think that he has influenced the current climate? I mean, I know there's been a great deal of change since the days when he was the prime minister. I mean, even since he passed away. But do you think, anyways, he kind of, I don't know if this is the right word, but he lingers over or he haunts the current climate?
I think so. Yes. I mean, he's thought of as being the ne plus ultra of leadership. When people think about great leadership, Winston Churchill is one of the people that, in fact, the primary person that Britons think of having been a good leader. And so it's pretty hard, of course, because on all leaders who've had to follow him, because thank God we haven't actually had that many wars since. And Churchill would not have become Prime Minister had it not been for the Second World War. And so it's rather difficult for people since Churchill to live up to the Churchillian brand of leadership, considering that that most of them have had to, again, thankfully, hold office in peacetime.
I was thinking about how here in the US, since Franklin Roosevelt, the most anyone's ever been president is 8 years. So the amount of time that you can build your reputation is somewhat limited. So your influence and your personality doesn't seem to haunt the political climate for as long. In some ways, that's probably a bad thing. do you think that he had sort of an outsized influence on the way government is done in England, in the sense that, not in terms of that he was going to change the structure or anything, but there is a sense in which the monarchy, for example, seems to have less influence than it did in earlier generations. And the monarchy is something of a mysterious sort of thing to us that we don't fully understand the influence of. But did Churchill have an impact on the way people now think about the monarchy in terms of maybe it not being as powerful or as worthy of respect as it was? And not being British, I don't know that I can fully express what I'm trying to ask here.
I don't think Churchill had very much influence constitutionally. In fact, there's nothing that he left as part of his legacy with regard to the constitution that wasn't there before. Okay. The monarchy had already effectively lost all of its powers, except for prerogative powers that it never uses. And although he, of course, worshipped and adored, had a bit of a crush on Her Majesty the Queen, he was, of course, her first Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. He didn't actually, he wasn't responsible for the weakening of any monarchical power, because that had all pretty much gone in the time of the Queen's grandfather.
Well, what about in terms of the way people thought about the monarchy? Do you think that because of his reputation and his sort of, he was kind of a larger than life figure, did he in some ways did that overshadow the crown, or do you think that the, or I mean, I guess the queen is a pretty outsized figure in her own right.
Well, the point is that the king, King George the Sixth, of course, was great during the war. He visited lots of bombed out cities. He and the queen, by which I mean his wife, the queen, later the queen mother, were brave during the war. Their house was hit during the bombing, of course, Buckingham Palace. And so she and the king were beloved in their own right, quite apart from anything that Winston Churchill had anything to do with.
Yeah, it's a hard to have, as an American. It seems like for us the monarchy is what we see on the crown.
You mustn't for 1 minute believe that anything in that television show is accurate. It isn't. It's the most appallingly historically inaccurate show. There are little pamphlets that are written over here with the many hundreds of historical errors that are made in that program. I gave up watching it after the first series because it was just so inaccurate.
I mentioned that I was interviewing you, and someone in the office said, well, I should ask you about that show. But what, aside from the historical inaccuracies, which I've read about, what do you think of the various representations or portrayals of Churchill that have been in television and in film in the last several years?
Oh, well, I loved the Gary Oldman movie, The Darkest Hour. It was super. Not just the prosthetics that he wore, but also that glint in his eye, and it brought over the sort of sheer fun side of Churchill. And that was a great movie, and it was pro Churchill as well, which is fairly unusual. The last three movies have been rather anti Churchill, so actually it was super. I thought there were certain scenes that were completely ludicrous. The scene, of course, in the underground station when Churchill took the subway and effectively used the people there as a focus group about whether or not he should continue to fight Hitler. Was completely absurd, owing to the fact that he never went on the underground, and he didn't need to ask the British people. He knew that he wanted to fight on against Hitler under all circumstances, and so it sort of detracted in a way from his greatness, because it implied he asked for the opinion of the British people, which he didn't. He imposed his opinion on the British people. Which is a much more heroic thing to do, in my view.
Do you think he viewed himself as a hero?
No. He was tremendously modest, actually. He was surprisingly modest. He, when he spoke and wrote about the Second World War, he never demanded the kind of approbation that various other people like Montgomery or Lord Mountbatten did. He probably knew that he was heroic, but he was the last man in the world ever to draw that to anybody else's attention.
Is that a particularly British thing, do you think?
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think so, but I'm not sure. I mean, what it does, of course, is to achieve exactly the thing that he's, I suppose, slightly setting out to do, because by not drawing attention to his own heroism, he's rather forcing the rest of us to do that.
Right, and I suppose the reason I put the question that way is because, as you said, there he had a sense of destiny and thus sort of a sense of duty that this was the thing he was called to do or that he was supposed to do.
It's a really important aspect of his life, this one, and one can't really understand Churchill, I don't believe, unless you factor in this concept of his sense of destiny. He had nearly died so many times, and he believed all the way through his youth and earlier years before he became Prime Minister. And he believed that, as he put it, invisible wings were flapping over him. He didn't believe in Jesus Christ, but he, or at least, didn't believe Jesus Christ was divine. But he did believe in an Almighty. When you look at the duties of the Almighty, it seems that all the Almighty ever really had to do was to look after Winston Churchill. That was his primary task in existence. And he certainly did that very well. And Churchill therefore did survive until 1940 in order to fulfil this destiny that even as a 16-year-old boy, Churchill had mapped out for himself.
You mentioned that he didn't believe in the divinity of Christ, but that he did believe in an Almighty. Was there something that motivated or drove or inspired his courage, if not some sort of faith? I mean, was that faith in a higher power type of idea? Was that enough to drive his faith? Or was it much more driven by self-respect and
it was driven by self-belief. Also, of course, his ancestor, his great ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, he was born at Blenheim, which is a huge memorial, really, to the victories of the Duke of Marlborough in the wars of Spanish Succession in the early 18th century. And he was taught at his school, Harrow, that that it was important for everybody to be as heroic as possible. And there was an ethos at that point in late Victorian England that he fully conformed to. And of course, he was an army officer, and he'd seen a lot of action in five campaigns in four wars by the end of the First World War. So he was on four continents by the end of the First World War. So there was a sort of ethic that he conformed to, which was not in any sense a Christian one, but one that was no less powerful for him for that.
Well, I won't keep you too much longer. I wanted to ask you something that I don't think you've been asked in other interviews that I've seen. When I was in school, I read his History of the English Speaking Peoples books, and I still have those on my shelves and like to pick them up sometimes, if for no other reason than I enjoy reading the way he wrote for some reason. So I was wondering what you as a historian think of those volumes that he put together and what you think of his output as a writer.
That's a good question. His output as a writer, which was enormous, it's bigger than Shakespeare and Dickens put together.
And he got them through a war. That's pretty remarkable.
And he did indeed. And he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, of course, in 1953. But yes, many of them still bear rereading. His biography of the great Duke of Marlborough, his four-volume biography, is a superb book. His autobiography, My Early Life, is lovely. His collection of essays, Great Contemporaries, definitely bears rereading, not just for the historical insights and the aperçu, but also because of the writing, this wonderful sort of Macaulay-esque, almost Gibbon-esque language that he uses. He could be wildly inaccurate, frankly. He of course placed himself at the center of his memoirs of the First World War and Second World War very much. But he argued that these were not intended to be objective history. They were his case, and he was making it. So one has to, I think, factor that in. The other point I think that's important to remember with regard to his writing is that he was always broke all his life. He literally didn't get into the black until he was in his early 70s. And so he was actually writing for an audience, for money, trying to get the maximum number of people to read it. And so he was writing in a deliberately accessible way. And that's very good news, because it means that even 100 years later, he's still tremendously readable. And one of the great pleasures of this book, one of many great pleasures of researching this book, has been reading his own work.
Well,
as far as, and you asked specifically, of course, the beginning of the question about the history of the English-speaking peoples. I mean, that's a classic example of that. It does bear rereading. However, he actually tells the story of Alfred burning the cakes, King Alfred the Great burning the cakes, for example, as though it were true, rather than pointing out that it's almost certainly a myth. So you know, one can't take absolutely everything Winston Churchill says for serious historical truth.
Do you think that in some cases he's doing that kind of with a wink, that he's just having
some
fun?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, and you pick it up. Anybody reading between the lines at all about that, and also in my early life, is, for example, he claims that he was absolutely rubbish at Latin. And he has lots of very funny jokes about how bad at Latin he was. But then when you actually go to read his school reports of when he was a young pupil, in fact, he was rather good at Latin. He turned out to be in the top third of every class at Latin, and and there's no indication that he was anything like as bad as he claimed to have been later.
Was that sort of self-deprecation common to him throughout his whole life?
Yes, it's you see it, and he uses it to devastating effect, especially actually in the Second World War when he was being attacked in the House of Commons at votes of confidence, which could have theoretically brought down his government, and he would make jokes, and the jokes would be self-deprecating, and the House of Commons would fall about with laughter at these gags, and it helped him. His sense of humour helped him enormously politically.
Well, one final question for you, and then I'll let you go. What is the one thing? Well, what is, in a book this long, I shouldn't say what is the one thing. What is one thing that was most surprising to you, or that you took the most pleasure in, that you discovered as you were researching for this book?
I can't say I took enormous amounts of pleasure discovering it, but I think it was tremendously interesting. And that is in the King's diaries, it becomes very clear that Churchill was profoundly disappointed with the Roosevelt administration for not getting more into the Second World War. It, of course, was Adolf Hitler declaring war on America on the 11th of December 1941 that brought you into the war in the West 4 days after you'd been attacked in Pearl Harbor in the Pacific. So it was there was a grinding sense of frustration and irritation in Churchill for very many months before that happened, that what he very much saw as being the central war for civilization, to save civilization, was not something that that the Roosevelt administration wanted to move America towards more effectively than it did.
That sort of brings us back to the original comment that I made, right? That he was interested in protecting civilization, and that wasn't such an American concern.
Yes, and one gets very strongly from these diaries, from the King's diaries, and the King, of course, agreed with him very much that had the Americans got more committed earlier on. I mean, of course, had you been committed in the 1920s and 1930s, there might not have been a war at all, because Germany could well have seen the prospect of taking on the United States as well as France and Britain as being an unwinnable situation. But nonetheless, it does come through powerfully in the King's diaries, and therefore also, of course, in my book.
Did that end up impacting the way that Churchill felt about Americans in general? I mean, would he have a negative view of...
No, not at all. Once we got into the war, he was delighted. And of course, by September 1943, when he made his Harvard speech, he actually wanted to investigate ways about whether or not Britain and America could have some kind of joint citizenship. He loved America. He was half American himself, needless to say. He coined the phrase the special relationship and totally believed in it. But when in that period, when you were fairly isolationist and there were lots of powerful isolationist voices in your Congress, he was undoubtedly deeply frustrated by it.
I have my grandmother was German. She lived in Berlin, well, in Potsdam during the war. And she, I remember when hearing stories about what the German people thought of Churchill and how after the war, in some cases, they actually were relieved because of how courageous he was and how much he stood up to Hitler. I mean, at the time, before the war, I don't think,
many Germans really fully realized what was going on or what they were had gotten themselves into. But it's interesting the way that he has become sort of a figure of such prominence, who is known for his courage and steadfastness, even among the people that he was fighting for. And I don't know that that was universal to all the German people. I suspect not. But I remember hearing stories about that from my
grandfather. Well, funny enough, he was cheered when he went to visit Berlin in July 1945. He was cheered in the streets. Mm. And the Germans don't have the kind of hatred for Churchill that you still get amongst certain other populations. In fact, my book, I think, is about to be sold. The German translation rights about to be sold any day now, which is pretty impressive. I'm not sure that there are many books about somebody who effectively conquered a country where that country is keen to read all about him in a positive way, at least.
Hmm. That's a pretty remarkable. That says a lot about him as a figure. And about your book, by the way. So thank you so much for being here, and thank you for writing this book, and best of luck. I wish you the best on all your travels and all your speaking, and I hope you sell a million copies.
you are kind. Thank you. I doubt I'll ever sell that number, but nonetheless, it's very, very kind of you to allow me onto the show.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.